Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. And during the day today, various times during the meditation instruction, Ajahn Metta, Ajahn Nanda Bodhi mentioned not getting lost in the various stories that we tell ourselves. This is one of the favorite habits of the mind, isn't it? Certainly, I can relate to this being possessed of an active storytelling mind. Even being known for storytelling, telling them, even writing them nowadays. So I can empathize with this area. But it's something that is helpful for us to understand. And so I thought I might offer a few reflections on this domain of our experience this evening. One of the most essential teachings in the Pali Canon on meditation, some of the most useful meditation advice comes in a fairly short sutta in the middle-length discourses. It's called the Madhupindika Sutta. Madhu means honey or sweet. Pindika means a morsel or a lump, a ball. So sometimes it's translated as the Honey Ball Sutta or the Sweet Morsel, the Delectable Discourse, those kind of things. And the reason it got that name at the end is because Ananda was listening to the Buddha talk about this. Said, "Oh, this is amazing! This is absolutely the most delectable, delightful, sweetest teaching. This is like the most beautiful and wonderful of nectar of Dhamma. This is like a ball of honey." And what should we call this sutta, Venerable Sir? He said, "You can call it the Honey Ball Sutta if you like." So thus it was, became the Madhupindika Sutta in the wake of Ananda's overexcited enthusiasm, but it is a very sweet and helpful teaching. It starts off with the Buddha sitting alone in a forest, and this apparently arrogant, cocky, young Brahmin scholar called Dandapani, which means stick in hand, he comes swaggering through the woods, striding along, apparently looking for a opportunity to display his wisdom and his erudition and so forth. And in India in those days, as still today, the realm of religious debate is very fertile, very active. Different spiritual teachers and philosophers love to debate and argue, compete for who's got the most refined philosophy, who can leave the other without an argument, and so on and so forth. So the scenario is that the young Dandapani comes sauntering through the forest and sees the Buddha sitting at the foot of a tree, and thinks, "Aha! Here's someone I can debate with. Let's see if I can put this samana, this yogi, to shame and make him look like a fool and prove how wonderful and smart and clever I am." how superior my teaching is. This is the sort of implications of the introduction to the beginning passages of the sutta. So then the young Dandapani comes striding up and sort of stands in front of the Buddha, sort of leaning on his stick and saying, pray, tell me, venerable sir, oh, Samana, what is it that you teach? What is the philosophy that you proclaim? What is it, the spiritual path that you practice? And the whole tone of it is like, okay, show me what you got, and I'm bound to be able to completely stun you with my superior teaching and understanding and knowledge and so on and so forth. And then the Buddha, in his inimitable way, said, Dandapani, the kind of teaching I practice, the kind of doctrine that I follow, is such a one that involves non-contention, not disputing with anyone in the world. It's such a teaching that involves freedom from obsession with perceptions, such perceptions that lead to the craving for sense pleasure, intoxication with sense pleasure, that lead to perplexity, that lead to doubt, that lead to the craving to become, the craving to be, or the craving to not be, for annihilation, bhava tanha and vibhava tanha. This is the kind of teaching that I practice. This is what I proclaim. So Dandapani then, as it describes in the sutta then, completely unable to come up with a response for that, you know, clicked his tongue, puckered his brow into three lines, and into deep furrows, and having nothing to say, goes striding off into the forest again, leaving the Buddha alone. And this is one of those neat little incidents, especially if you're a Buddhist, and I'm sure the Brahmins would read the sutra in a different way and say, obviously, the Buddha was just wriggling out of it, and he really didn't have anything to answer it with. But this is the introduction to the sutta, because what's happening is that this fellow is kind of looking for an argument. He's looking for a debate. He's trying to get the Buddha to rise to the bait. And the Buddha sees that's the energy behind this apparently innocent question. What do you teach? What do you practice? What's your spiritual path in life? And the Buddha doesn't get fooled by the content, the seemingly innocently content, the sweet bait wrapped around the hook, and he sees the hook and sees this guy's just looking for an argument. Well, he can have his argument, but not with me. And so he says, I teach and follow a practice of non-contention, of not disputing with anyone in the world, not any spiritual teachers, other human beings, Brahmas, Devas, or any being anywhere in the world. So then as he went back to the monastery, and then he met with some of the monastics there, and then briefly described this encounter, and then having just pointed out how this is the in a way a little synopsis of what had happened between him and Dandapani, then he took off and took leave of the rest of the sangha and went off to his kuti, to his cabin, and went away. And so the monks who were left there thought, well, what did he mean by that? He just said this thing about non-disputing and how the clinging to perceptions causes quarrels and disputes and argument in the world. So, what did he mean by that? And how are we supposed to understand that? So then they thought, well, the Venerable Kachana, not our Kachana, this is the last monk here, is Venerable Kachana, but his predecessor, the Arahant Kachana, he was most famous. He had the title of being the one who was most accomplished in explaining in extended detail brief utterances of the Buddha. So I thought, aha, Kachana. Let's go to Kachana and see if he can explain this to us, because we can't really figure out what the Buddha meant by that brief statement about clinging to perceptions leading to quarreling and disputing. So then the Venerable Kachana is the one who lays out the main essence of the sutta and this very helpful meditation guidance. And so then they find Venerable Kachana and ask him, you know, what is it? What did the Buddha mean when he said this thing about perceptions and causing quarrels and disputes? And we didn't really get that. And it was just this brief little statement, and then he went off to his kuti and left us all hanging here. What did he mean? So then the Venerable Kachana said how, well, when the way it works is when we experience any kind of sense contact, when the eye perceives a form, as a sense contact, the eye perceives a form, and then there's eye consciousness arises from that. The object, the sense organ, and the consciousness coming together, those three form contact, or passa. When there's contact, there is feeling, a pleasant feeling, painful feeling, a neutral feeling. That feeling leads to a perception, so that, say we see something, and that perception, the sanya, which is related to the English word sign, the mind then designates what that perception is. It perceives blue or green or yellow or red. There's a designation, as a basic ordering of the experience. Then the sanya leads to thinking. The thinking mind that says, that's blue, or that's red, that's big, that's small, that's far away, that's near. So there's the contact, like the initial impact with the sensory system. There's the feeling element, then that broadens or blossoms into the sanya, designating the sort of raw sense formation. And then the thinking mind comes in, and this is vitakka, the conceptual thinking mind, and that draws upon memory, upon language, and puts it together and says, that's blue, that's green, that's red, that's far away, that's near, and so on and so forth. And then the conceptual mind, the thought, then leads to papancha, and this is the key player in this drama, papancha. Wonderful word, not really translatable into English, sometimes rendered as conceptual proliferation, which is a bit of a tongue twister, but that's kind of suitable, since papancha is really the mind twister, or prolixity. It's the chattering mind is really what it's about, because the capacity to think on its own is something fairly simple and straightforward. Papancha is then that habit of mind that then takes a thought, like it's blue. It says, yeah, but that's not very nice blue, is it? I think actually it kind of reminds me of that blue that the teapot had. It has a nice teapot. God, what did they do to the spout of it? Those monks at Abhayagiri, you know, it's my favorite teapot, and they go and bash it against the tap. And, you know, we really ought to have more classes in mindfulness. You know, off it goes. This is papancha. And so the eye sees form, then it says, there's the sanya, blue, and then, or teapot, says the thinking mind. So there's the sanya itself is wordless, and then it's when the vitakka comes in. So before the naming happens, the sanya is there that recognizes a pattern or formulates it. Then the vitakka comes in and says, teapot, blue teapot. Then the papancha takes over. And then papancha leads to its offspring of what's called papancha sanya sankhara, which is the multiplicity of feelings and perceptions that beset the heart and cause the feeling of pressure or alienation, the feeling of burdenedness that we experience in relationship to the world. That's a kind of long translation for it's already a long compound word, but it's pretty much what it means. So it goes from that initial sense contact, something hit, light hits the eye, and then in its very rapid succession, it turns into me being burdened by the world, whether it's something that is irritating, that we dislike and is painful, or something that is attractive and that we want to get hold of, or something that is neutral and we are easily bored with or we ignore. But it's from this particular chain you can see how you end up with me in here with the world out there, either wanting something, irritated by something, afraid of something, or at least having an opinion about something. So this is a very, very useful habit, because this is where our stories come from. And because it's not just seeing light, but also the as we sit here in this hall, there's memories that come up, recollection of conversations that we've had, things that we've done, things that have been done to us, ideas about the future, what we're supposed to do, what's going to happen after the retreat finishes, what choices I have to make. So there's memory, there's planning, feelings in the body, that there's that funny twinge in your left knee that starts off as just the sense impact, the little kind of the action potentials go charging up your nerves through your leg into your spinal cord up to your brain and says pain. Then the thinking mind comes in and says pain in my left knee. Then the papancha comes in and says, ooh, that's not a normal pain. Now I've had that one in the right knee before, but it wasn't quite the same as that, and that turned out to be nothing special. Well, this feels kind of different. It's got a kind of gnarly, twisted feel. It's got a kind of sharp, sort of broken glass type feeling to it. And I'm sure that's the meniscus, isn't it? Oh, gee, what happened? Oh, gee, what happened to Ajahn Pasno's knee? Gee, he has to wear a knee brace all the time, and I don't want that to happen to me. I mean, that's really a headache. Maybe it's time for me to move. I really ought to take more care of this left knee. Oh. Suddenly, here's me, pressured by the dangers of what happened to my knee, and it happens really fast, doesn't it? This goes from the impact of the feeling to the visualization of us being wheeled out on a gurney. I wonder how they'll get the doors open when they wheel me out, or they'll bash my head. Those are pretty heavy oak doors. I hope they would have some padding on those doors for when they wheel me out. Insert your own fantasy here. So it can be any one of a number of channels. It can be something from an event, real, feeling in the body, something that we see. I mean, here in this very Christian hall, with now in the evening time, with the shadows thick, we're not so surrounded. Those of you who are ex-Catholics or current Catholics or recovering Catholics, probably having all kinds of experiences with the Stations of the Cross. Us recovering Anglicans, I never came across the Stations of the Cross till I came here to America and started doing retreats in Catholic retreat centers. So it doesn't really mean much for me, but the crucifix is definitely there. That triggers my Anglican conditioning. But whatever it might be, whether it's a thing that we see, or something that we hear, noises outside, even the absence of noises outside. Like here we are in this different hall. So last year, every year we get this ghastly football game going, and we had to really endure that every time we came on the retreat at Angela Center. It's really great. This year we haven't got a football game. This is really marvelous. This is a great improvement. I've really got to write and tell Ajahn Amara, really, this is a great thing. Maybe they'll move it back to the other place next year. Oh, we can't have that. Now, if I write and tell Ajahn Amara that I really like this new hall, I have to really kind of make some sort of dharmically appropriate hint that it would really be a bad idea to go back to the other place because that football game is really irritating. It really interrupts my meditation. You can't hear the football game, but the commentator's still hard at it. Yeah. Freelance commentary provided at no extra cost. So it doesn't take much. It doesn't take anything at all, actually. Just that mind that's looking for something to chew on. And in that little expression of the Buddha, that the mind that has given up obsession with perceptions that relate to sense, craving for sense pleasure, that lead to perplexity, to doubt, to the desire to become or the desire to get rid of. It's that the mind that's given up those particular qualities. So, and sometimes that urge to become, that's the driving force. We don't even realize that. Bhava tanha, the desire to be, or its partner, its twin, the desire to not be, to get rid of, to switch off, to not feel, to get away, to not be. These are the unholy twins. Bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. That just that force, that habit within the heart can be what drives the mind hungering for something to get some papancha going. Just some kind of fuel, so that it'll feel like there's a me here, at least existing in relationship to a world, pushing against it, running away from it, or doing something, at least having an opinion about it. And we don't notice that, but this is what drives so many of the stories that take shape in our mind and carry us away and create this quality of pressure, of stress, of burdenedness within us. The heart carried away into endless distraction, and the feelings of alienation, loneliness, the feelings of being me out here, oppressed, burdened, troubled by the world, stressed by the things of the world. So once we get used to this process or seeing how this works, it can be a very powerful and helpful tool, because oftentimes we don't even realize it's happening. It happens so quickly that we're already halfway through our commentary about the football game that we can't hear, or visualizing the knee surgery we're going to require, or some fantasy about our future, the perfect relationship that's off there, or how our beautiful new monastery is going to be up in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And what should we call it? What shall we call it? Oh dear. I've been through that. Green Mountain, now they got one of those over in Vermont already. You could call it off it goes, the mind goes charging through the lists. So we see that happening. The stories get charged up, or the very significant and important conversation about events in the Sangha that we were having yesterday. A very fruitful and helpful conversation in many ways. But isn't it striking how much a conversation like that just carries on and on? We replay things that we heard, things that we said, things that we wanted to say, or things that we felt inclined to say but were glad that we didn't say, or things that we're sort of saving up to say next time. There's the memory of the encounter, the conversation, and then off it goes. So once we get used to this pattern, we begin to recognize how it works as the contact, feeling, perception, thinking, conceptual proliferation, and then the whole prolixity of perceptions and feelings that enmesh and bind the heart and create the sense of alienation. me in tension with me in here at in a state of tension with the world out there. When we see that, then we begin to understand how to work it. Because oftentimes it happens so fast. We're out there in the middle of the me, alienated from the world. We're kind of, it's like coming to in the pool of broken glass with bare feet, thinking, how did I get here? And how do I get out of this? And how do I deal with this? We start off with that feeling of being lost in our story, lost in our thought. So one of the very useful ways of working with this is to think, oh, hang on a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. So here I am composing this note, or here I am rehearsing this conversation, or here I am. So now where did this come from? And we can trace back the chain of our thinking. We can follow it back. And in the Korean tradition, they have a beautiful expression for this. It's called tracing back the radiance. I don't know the Korean expression for it, but that's how it's translated into English. Tracing back the radiance. So from wherever you find yourself in the midst of a particular story, whether it's a sexual fantasy or a plan for your new monastery in the Santa Cruz Mountains, or what's happening with the monastery that you're currently constructing in the coastal range up in Redwood Valley, that you notice where the mind has got to, and then just follow back the succession of thoughts that led to that, and then you can go from the middle of this construction project to then, you know, they think, oh well, it was the sound, I heard the sound of a truck going by, and I thought, oh, only that's the first truck I've heard. Not like one of those busy days at Abhayagiri. That was it. It was the faint sound of a truck going past the hall here at Angela Center. So it was a sound. All it was a sound. That's where it came from. So that you trace the pattern of thought as well as you can and then bring it back to that root. Trace it back to its origin. And then to reflect, oh, it was just a sound. That's all. The ear hears sound, and then all the rest of that world blossomed forth, came forth from that, kind of sprang out of that. Look at that, it was just a sound. And then there's a tremendous power that comes from following things back in that way, going back and thinking, oh look, that's where it all began. It was just this one little thought, this one little story, this one little idea, and then whoop. This whole universe appeared from it. It's my version of a Big Bang. Kind of balloons into existence, and there it is. So when we see how this works, and we see how the mind runs in this way, then we're much more able to catch that process earlier and earlier as it takes shape. That we're able to not be drawn in, because in stories in themselves are not harmful or they're not dangerous or problematic. It's just that we believe in them. We take them to be true, and we buy into them. That's where the trouble begins, is that there's the clinging to the stories the mind creates, that the story that I'm terrible, I'm useless, I'm hopeless, or I'm incredibly sick and I'm never gonna have a life apart from this terrible illness or this ailment or this problem that's besetting me, or if I get hold of that, if I manage to strike up a conversation and get the interest of that deeply attractive person in row 5, cushion 4, I know I'll be happy forever. And that We believe in those stories. That when we recognize, oh, this is just a story, why should it be true? It's just a little fantasy, a creation that's ballooned out of this tiny seed crystal of a sound or a feeling or a passing image or a scent or a flavor. That's all. then we are able to live with the stories or see them happening and not be caught up and dragged into the state of alienation and stress or burdenness. So clinging, as usual, the clinging is the culprit, is the difficulty in this process. So that when we see the mind launching into its stories and caught up, then in a way the first thing to do is to cultivate a degree of spaciousness around that thought, the story, the dread of something terrible happening, or the excitement of the fantasy, or the sweetness of the relived memory, just to bring some space around that and say, oh yes, that was a really sweet moment, that was really sweet, but it happened 30 years ago and she's 53 like you are now. She's not still 21. Darn. It changed. The mind is always capable of finding space around a story. Like, it really shouldn't have been that way. He shouldn't have done that. That's totally wrong. Yes, you feel very distinctly and clearly that should not have been done. Right. That's the feeling. That is the feeling. It's here right now. Where did it come from? So you're not suppressing, you're not arguing against the thoughts that are there. You're not negating or dismissing in a repressive way, but just allowing space around that and seeing, yes, this is a really powerful feeling. This is a feeling of fear. This is a feeling of excitement. This is a feeling of nostalgia. This is a feeling of righteous indignation. Yes. This is a feeling of me. I am definitely and absolutely feeling like I'm right. I know for sure that I feel I'm right. And there's a difference between that and I am right. Right? there's some space around it. So that's how we allow the mind to trace back the radiance. That we are finding that quality of recognition that this is, regardless of its content and how compelling and interesting or frightening or painful or attractive that content is, it is just a mental event. This can be no more than a pattern of consciousness. It can't be anything more than that. And something in our heart knows that beyond any doubt whatsoever. So just using the power of the reflective mind to allow a bit of space around that, this is the crucial thing. Because part of us loves that quality of buying in, that becoming urge. We love that. Like, I am right. I want it. This is good. The yes feeling, or even the no. I hate such and such. We love that. There's a relish that comes, the relish of being, of bhava tanha. That's the kind of primal addictive, that's the primal drug in a way, that yes, I love it. That's the primal addiction, is to that buzz that we get from that. Because what it is the drug is I. It's an affirmation of the I feeling. I am, yes. And even what I am is, I am useless. I am the worst meditator. I have totally wasted the last 30 years. Really. There's a kind of thrill and a relish in that. It's totally perverse in some ways. But even in some kind of negative self-criticism, or I'm a complete failure, my life is utterly wasted. It's all been a total waste of time, a bad joke. I didn't even tell it well. And the I has got a sort of root satisfaction in it. That's bhava tanha, the desire to be that's the desire to exist, is being fed at that moment. So that's the primal drug, the primal addiction that is the driver of so much of our dukkha. It's that which is one of the most basic obscurations of the Dhamma. What obscures the realization of the Dhamma, occludes the Dhamma. So in this process, then, it's not a matter of wiping out, as I said, what we feel or what we think, or whether it's positive or negative, because that just becomes vibhava tanha, the desire to get rid of. This is a stupid story, get out of here. That's not really happening. Yeah, shut up, go home. I'm fed up with this, I'm out of here. Just that which wants to switch off, to not feel, to not be, to get out. Yeah, it's natural enough. And there's a relish in that as well. Just, I've had it. I'm fed up. There's a relish in that as well, but that's just, in a way, it's the same as its partner of bhavatanna, the desire to become. So the antidote, or the way that we work with this most successfully, says I find, is finding some space around that judgment, just that. And what Ajahn Chah would encourage is cultivating, it's called anicca sanya, the cultivating the perception of uncertainty. Anicca sanya. I mean, we often think of as anicca meaning just impermanence, but it also, the felt sense of impermanence is that of uncertainty. If things are changing, the way we experience it as a feeling is, you don't know what's going to happen next. I don't know what's going to happen next. I don't know what the whole story is. So cultivating the anicca sanya is when we listen to our stories, our urges, our fears, our desires, our becomings. Then to cultivate the anicca sanya is to say to it, is that so? Or if you're more like Southern English like myself, you go, really? Oh, really? Interesting. Is that so? Is that a fact? And that this is a very simple practice that Longpo Cha would encourage. Just whatever it is that arises in the mind, meet it with this same kind of reflection. Is that so? I can't stand it. This is too much. I can't bear it. I've had it. I'm out of here. Is that so? This is great. This is incredible. This is the best thing ever. This is so wonderful. Is that so? This is extraordinarily mediocre. This is so ordinary. This is worth absolutely nothing. It's not even worth disliking. It's so normal. Is that so? Like, dislike, approve, disapprove, disinterest, pleasure, pain, neutral feeling, beautiful, ugly, etc. Whatever it might be, if we train ourselves to meet every perception with, is that so? That's the very element that allows us to recognize, allows the wisdom faculty within us to recognize the space that's there around every condition that's experienced. Is that so? Is that so? Just having that mindfulness and applying that quality has a huge transformative effect. Because we are a culture that is very strongly conditioned to believing in thought in particular. You know, as I often say, that there's this fundamental cultural belief that if I think it, it's true. I mean, not just me. I mean, if we, whatever it is that we think, we assume that if it's going through our mind that it must be true. But it's more skillful to, in a sense, just relate to our thinking mind more like the neighbor's radio, that you can't even control what station they tune to. And let alone what the station puts out on the broadcast. It just, most of what we think is just random chattering and replayed oldies and jingles. It hardly even finishes a sentence. just sort of rattles on and on and on. But yet we take it so seriously and we believe its content. So learning to not believe our thoughts and to create some space around them, to see them as these are merely mental formations. But we like, as I say about bhava tanha, we really delight in that quality of being. There's a relish that comes with buying into an opinion or a thought or a fear. And it's important to recognize that, to see, there's something that's deeply satisfying in that buying into process. This is called the asada in Pali, the gratification. But the asada has its own partner, which is the adinava, which means the liability or the downside. So when we buy into a particular thought or a memory or a feeling or a passion, then we also get the downside, which is the result of having bought into something, is that we get the bill. We have the result of that buying into. Oh, so with this kind of use of reflection on papancha, conceptual proliferation, then when we recognize how much the mind likes to buy into things and takes hold of a story and runs with it, then as we see where we've got to, we allow a bit of space around it, then we find that it's because we're not taking the story so seriously, or we're saying, well, this is something I'm really afraid of happening, or this is something I really want, or something I really disapprove of. This is something this is the worst thing, this pain in my leg, or having a sore throat, or digestive problems, bad knees when you're a person who's supposed to be a professional sitter. This is really inconvenient. There's that recognition of, oh, this is what I don't want. It feels like this. And then tracing it back to the source. Oh, it's just a feeling in my knee. It's just a memory. It's just the replaying of a conversation right now. And this is what it is. And what you find is that as the mind returns to the source, that feeling of alienation or pressure or burdenness or stress or longing, that gets more and more diminished until when the mind is right there at the feeling or the mood or the memory, then it's extraordinarily simple. There's a quality of wholeness, a quality of fullness. And in a way, this is the theme for this retreat, fullness of being. The more classical method of expressing that in Pali is the cessation of becoming, bhava nirodha. It's because, and you might think like cessation of becoming sounds like annihilation or just not, switching everything off or not feeling. But that's not the case. It's like when the mind is free from that becoming urge and getting caught up in that hungering, that, as the Buddha said, ever seeking fresh delight, now here, now there, tatra tatra nandiraga sahagata, ever seeking fresh delight, now here, now there. That's when we mysteriously, when we let go of that seeking fresh delight, relishing this and that, nandiraga sahagata, then, mysteriously, when we come back to the, we relinquish that feverish chasing and relishing, and we come back to the root, that's where the quality of fullness of being is really experienced. When the mind is not chasing something that it's angry about, or something that it's longing for, or something it's got an opinion about, or something that it's remembering, or is anxious over. And it's mysterious and amazing how it works, because we think, I'm not full, so I need to get some of this, and I need to get a bit more of that, and a little more of this, and a couple of those, and five of these, and as many as I can possibly get my hands on of those, and then I'll be full, and then I'll have fullness of being, that will be great. And that it's by that sense of recognizing that restless movement and where it comes from, coming back to the source, that we find ourselves mysteriously aware of this inherent fullness of being that was always here, but because of the mind being distracted, caught up in this process of papancha, we get dragged away from the source, the mind leaping onto conditions of thought and feeling and opinion, then that quality of fullness is not recognized, is not realized. So then we keep hunting for something out there to make us feel complete. Now, one of the things that's most seductive about thought is that when we know that we're right, we've got, yeah, but I do need to get rid of my laziness. I need to stop thinking so much. It's true. Or that I need to get, or something that was, that we've experienced, something that was done. We know that was, but that was wrong. Look, I mean, I've got facts here. Here's my list. You see, this was, you know, here's evidence. Here's the data to prove it. I've got statistics. I've got transcripts. I've got the emails. I printed them out. It's all here in print. These are facts. It's true. It's actually true. One of the things I find really useful to reflect on is two particular words I often look at very closely, and I've trained myself to have a kind of an alarm system over a number of years when the word fact is used and when the word actually is used. Have you ever noticed if a sentence begins with the word actually, very very often what follows it is something that is going to cause an argument, or there's a kind of stress around that. But actually, it's like this, or actually, what is happening is this, or there's a way that we take an experience or some event or some thing and we substantialize it, if such a word exists, what it does now. We make it substantial. We reify it. We make it into a solid thing. And like the concept of a fact. I say, yeah, well, today is Sunday. I mean, that's the fact. Well, if you happen to be a human being who speaks English and is living on this planet, yeah, it's Sunday. But, you know, you can be absolutely sure that according to the chickens living in the farm next door, the word Sunday, or the noise Sunday, probably doesn't mean a lot to them. Yeah, to the trees in the garden here at the Angela Center, Sunday probably doesn't mean much. To our human conditioning and defining the turning of the planet, and the ones of the English speakers, then okay, it's Sunday. If you run on a lunar calendar, we have a different Sabbath day. Actually, we have our monastic community. We have two time zones going simultaneously all the time, so that we had our lunar observance for the new moon on Tuesday. So today being Sunday is, this is the fifth day of the waxing moon. How many of you woke up this morning and thought, fifth day of the waxing moon today? A few of you might have thought, oh, it's Sunday today. Maybe. But we don't customarily think in terms of the lunar calendar in this country. But in our monasteries, we have both calendars going simultaneously. But we, on an ordinary everyday level, we might think, well, the fact is it's Sunday. But a fact is necessarily a relative way of describing a particular patch of the universe by those who happen to be conscious of it and frame that perception in compatible ways. That's my humble assertion. But when you consider it, when we think of a thing or a fact, it's a kind of a human agreement that relates to particular patterns in the material world. Like you say, water boils at 100 degrees centigrade. Well, okay, that's close enough. Or you can say that hydrogen is made up of an electron and a proton. That's what hydrogen is. And yeah, that's a good enough description. But then if you ask a physicist, okay, what exactly is an electron? They go, oh. You think, grade school chemistry, that, well, you can define that, but the more expert somebody is, the more that they'll say, ooh, well, he can't really say exactly what that is. So I don't want to get into too sort of metaphysical about the whole thing, but what happens is that we take something that has a relative truth or something that is an agreed upon value, and the mind turns it into an absolute reality. We turns it into, this is the way it is, this particular perspective, this particular outlook, this is it. And even though they're on a conventional level, you say, yeah, well, it's Sunday, certainly by the convention, it's not Saturday in this particular country, fine. But it's that sliding, that drift from a relative truth to being an absolute reality. That's where the dukkha gets created. And that's, in a way, where avijja slips in. Ajahn Chah had a really, really beautiful expression for this. The kind of grasping at things in a well-intended way. And I was telling this story a couple of days ago at the monastery, where it recounts an incident where when Ajahn Sumedho was a young monk at Ajahn Chah's monastery, and he was a young American, very keen and diligent in his life as a monk, and very sort of properly behaved and tried to do everything right and appropriately. He'd been a monk for a few years, but he was still quite junior. But there was another monk who was, I believe, a few years senior to him, who was really loud-mouthed. And we know what those kind of people are like. Wouldn't stop talking. Kept going on and on and on. Was very loud and noisy, and always had opinions about things, and was very sort of coarse and blunt in his speech. And it was this real jarring presence around the monastery. And Ajahn Sumedho got more and more indignant and self-righteous about this, because nobody was saying anything. None of the other monks would correct him. And even Ajahn Chah wouldn't set him straight. And everyone could tell that this monk was totally out of order and really needed to be put in his place and told to just watch his speech habits and not be such an irritant and behave so badly and so inappropriately with the rest of the community. I mean, this is terrible, this is wrong, this is bad, it shouldn't be this way. And no one's saying anything. Someone should do something. And so this sort of, he stored this up in his mind and kept kind of noticing these feelings of righteous indignation appearing. And then he was, am I just reacting? Is this just my opinionated nature? Or am I just being too fussy? Or have I got a gripe against him for some reason? And then his thinking might say, well, no, he was talking in this terrible way to Ajahn so-and-so, and he was really rude to so-and-so, and he was so loud there, everyone could hear him halfway across the courtyard. And no, these are really bad and inappropriate things that shouldn't be done this way. This is not good and this is not right. And so he waited for an occasion, and he was really annoyed with Ajahn Chah because he just wasn't saying anything, and it was really his job as the Ajahn, as a teacher. He's so strict about things. How come he's letting this monk get away with this dreadful behavior? So then Ajahn Chah was away for a few days, and every 2 weeks we have the recitation of our monastic rule, as like on the new moon, full moon days that we just had on Tuesday. And Ajahn Chah was away. And then after the recitation of the rule, you know, and everyone is gathered there, then whoever's the senior person then usually asks, oh, is there any business that the Sangha needs to discuss? And oftentimes there's little practical things about, is it time to put a new roof on the shed, or have we decided who's going to go off to such and such a branch monastery and such like? And so at that particular occasion then, I guess it would have been Ajahn Liam, who was the second monk, said, you know, has anyone got any business to bring up? Then the young Ajahn Sumedho took this moment, and he had his script prepared. You know, he had his facts. You know, what this monk had said, and how, and when, and where, and who was upset, and how it had been, you know, really inappropriate and offensive. And so he said, yes, I have something I'd like to bring up, and this is I'd like to beg permission to address the issue of so Venerable So-and-so's speech. And he launched into his list. And he had all the dates, the occasions, what was said, and who was there, and he had witnesses. it was all absolutely correct. And during this whole time, the particular monks were sat there staring at the floor, and then when Ajahn Sumedho had finished, then no one else had anything else to add to that. And so the monk apparently was all, you know, beg forgiveness from the Sangha, terribly sorry, I'll try to do better in the future. And then after that meeting was finished, then Ajahn Sumedho thought, wow, that was really good. You know, I'm glad I got that off my chest. And I think it was really a service to the Sangha, and that's really done everyone a good turn. But he kind of noticed that other people weren't saying, kind of slapping him on the back and saying, well done, Sumedho, nice job, you really let him have it, that's good. You know, we've been waiting for that to happen for ages, but people just sort of went about their business and left him to it. And said, oh, it's kind of surprising, but no matter. And then the monk himself, who'd been so severely and publicly admonished and shamed, that he stayed around for a day or two and looked very sheepish and embarrassed and somewhat shriveled. And then after a couple of days, he just vanished. He left and disappeared, left the monastery. So a few days later, Ajahn Chah came back from his travels, and of course, word reached him pretty quickly, as it does in the scriptures when you read the accounts in the suttas. Like, this matter, they took this matter to the Lord. And so the whole incident was recounted to Ajahn Chah, how Tan Sumedho had laid into this monk after the recitation of the Patimokkha, and how this, you know, he'd said this and said that in such a way, and how the monk had, a couple of days later had taken off. And Ajahn Chah waited, and I'm telling this story, Ajahn Sumedho's told, the reason why I know it so well is Ajahn Sumedho's told it many, many times, so it's not sort of betraying any trust or not sort of secret information or anything. This is a well-known tale that he tells himself, and how Ajahn Chah then sort of waited for the right moment, and when there was either just the two of them or very few other people around, and he said, you know, Sumedho, you know what you said about that monk so-and-so? You know, it was true. What you said was true, you know, that you didn't present anything that was false. But you were right in fact, but wrong in Dhamma. Right in fact, but wrong in Dhamma. Because the way that you presented that, the way that you put that to him, you put it in a way, such a way that it was really not in accord with Dhamma. And so, yes, your facts were correct, but you made it impossible for him to live here. You shamed him so profoundly and so publicly that he couldn't live here. I knew his speech was terrible. Of course, yeah, everyone knew that. And the expression he used in Thai is, and I'll probably get the tones all wrong, was bark, bark, there, Jaidi, which means his mouth is evil, but his heart is good. Bak Bap, there, Jaidi. Yeah, he had some pretty bad speech karma, but his heart was really good. And this was, and because of that habit, this was one of the very, very few places that he could live as a monk. Now he can't, because of what you've done, he can't live here anymore. You know, you've made that impossible for him. So you have to accept that, Sumedho. You have to acknowledge that you're responsible for that. And I don't know where he's gone, and I don't know whether he'll be able to find a place to live. But you intended well, but the results of your actions were harmful and destructive. And so, may this be something that you learn from. And that was advice and feedback that was given in a very kindly and gentle, fatherly way from the teacher. And it obviously stayed with Ajahn Sumedho ever since. And I found it incredibly helpful advice, because that reflects a principle of what's called Dhammanudhamma Patipata, practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. And this is one of the characteristics of stream entry, of real maturity in the path, is not just practicing Dhamma according to your own opinion or according to what the book says or according to what the authority says or according to habit, but practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. So that you're not just right in fact, but you're right in fact, but also you're seeing things in their context. You're seeing things according to their fundamental nature. So that when we are relating to our own thoughts, our own feelings, our judgments about ourselves, being a wonderful person or a stupid person, or judging others as being wonderful people or stupid people or good people or bad people, when we are judging our actions from the past or whatever it might be, our feelings or thoughts or sense experiences, that it's so important to if we are looking at our experience and learning to judge things, that we relate to those, to rightness and wrongness, goodness and badness, and so forth, not just in terms of what fits our opinion or our habits of thinking or the customary judgment and beliefs around us. But but we respond in what's in accord with Dhamma itself. What's a way to respond to this that actually fits, that accords with reality, that fits in with the way things are? So that might seem a bit subtle or a bit hard to grasp. Well, it's not surprising. The Dhamma is sometimes a tricky principle. It's not that easily graspable. But what this is pointing to is just not going along with our habits, or not just believing in our judgments or our habits of thinking, but putting things in a context, having that reflective quality present that says, okay, well, this is what I see as being a fault in myself, or something that I see as being good or delicious. Now, what's the story? Or why is that so? Where's that coming from? Is that the same for everyone? So we're expanding the view, broadening the view around our experiences, the way we look at our own mind, our own life, the way we look at the world around us, so that then we are able to not just come from a place of reactivity, but there's a responsivity. The heart is in accord with the actuality of the way things are. Actually in accord with actuality. But just to see that the mind that wants to grasp a fact or say, well, actually it's like this, that's in a way a flag, a sign to say, whoa, don't trust it. Be careful. Tread carefully. And that seeing that any kind of a fact or anything that we say is actually true or actually this way, that that's a clear signal to like take a step back and make sure you let some extra space be there around that particular feeling or thought or mood, and say, well, what is going on here? Is this so? Is this really the way it is? Is that a fact? And then in that, allowing that spaciousness around it, we allow the intuitive wisdom of the heart to really feel out the whole of the situation and have a more complete and fundamentally realistic apprehension of how things are. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.